So, Berto, what do you remember about the Beach Boys?
Well, as a kid in Colombia, the Beach Boys didn't mean much to me, honestly, because I knew the name. Like, I'd heard the Beach Boys, and I literally associated them with beach music. And if someone had asked me, like, hey, do you know the Beach Boys? I probably would have said, yeah, they sing those songs with, like, woo, we're surfing, you know, or something like that. I'm not sure I would have been able to sing one of their songs.
Yeah.
That was me in Colombia.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid on KJR here in Seattle, KJR was the big AM radio station back then, and I remember listening to the Beach Boys there, but I never really loved them. I just knew a few of their songs that were kind of silly. And then in the 80s, David Lee Roth covered California Girls. Do you remember that?
I do remember it, but I didn't know at the time that it was a cover. I just assumed it was his song.
Oh, really? That's funny. 1985. I just actually watched the video, the music video. In 1985, I was 14 years old, so I was ground zero for MTV watching 24/7. Plus, it was kind of the golden age of MTV.
What's MTV?
It's where they have a lot of reality TV shows.
What does the M stand for?
Well, back in the day, it stood for music TV.
And what?
Now it stands for mundane, I'm guessing.
Do you mean like a channel where they would show music?
Yeah. 24/7, and they would cycle the same 20 or so videos throughout the week. And I probably saw this David Lee Roth California Girls video a billion times. And it has a weird, like, 2-minute intro into the video where it's supposed to be comedic.
Yeah.
And it was at the height of David Lee Roth's fandom. It came right after 1984, which is Van Halen's biggest album. And then David Lee Roth famously leaves Van Halen and starts his own weird cover, you know, where he does, I'm just a gigolo.
Yeah.
And everywhere. I mean, these songs were huge. Anyway, so I remember California Girls from there. And then I remember Kokomo later in the 80s.
I will say when that movie came out, Cocktail.
Was it Cocktail?
Cocktail, yeah. That song got popular on the top 40. That is actually the first time where I remember saying, oh, I like these Beach Boys. Because I actually liked that song.
God, I hate that song.
I would sing it all the time. I was like, Aruba, Jamaica. And you know what struck me about it?
It's a terrible song.
No,
a terrible song.
The harmonies is what struck me. Because I used to love harmonies. And I heard it on the radio. I was like, whoa, those are really interesting harmonies.
Well, when you take shit and you harmonize it, that doesn't make it good. It just makes it harmonizing shit.
Ooh, I want to take it. Come on, man. It was pretty.
It was terrible. Then as an adult, I remember coming across a sort of B-side or a lesser-known Beach Boys song called Don't Worry, Baby. Don't worry, baby, everything will turn out all right. Okay. And I loved this song so much, the chords and the harmonies. Mm-hmm. It was like so rich and was sad. It just had this melancholy to it. And I just had to learn how to play it. There's certain songs where I hear it and I just say, I have to learn this song. I have to know what makes this song tick. And the chords are actually quite simple, but there's a lot of sevenths in it, and they're voiced in an interesting way, and the lyrics are actually really funny because the chorus is, "Don't worry, baby, everything will work out all right. Don't worry, you know." But in between are the verses, and the verses are this guy who he has a girlfriend, and he's in high school. And he has this sweet car that goes fast. And this guy, this rival, challenges him to a race. And he can't help himself. He has to challenge him because his car is faster. And it alternates, I think, between him telling his girlfriend, don't worry, everything's going to be all right when I race this guy. And then his girlfriend saying to him, don't worry, baby, everything's going to be all right. So it's this really beautiful song, but the lyrics and the verses are just silly and just goofy. It's almost like a Weird Al song in some ways.
So I really discovered the Beach Boys in high school, because what happened is I moved up to the States when I was 15. And prior to that, my only exposure to music was whatever was on the radio on top 40 and about 4 albums that I owned, because I didn't really have the money to buy records. And That was it. And I didn't have MTV down in Colombia. So it was, that was, those were my sources. I also moved up here and I started working in the part-time in McDonald's. So I started having a little extra cash. And so I went to Tacoma Mall and I started, I would start buying, records that I had either heard of, things that I had learned as a kid, or maybe a song that was popular in the top 40. And I remember talking to people about what are some of the greatest albums. And one of the ones they said is like, well, you got to get Pet Sounds.
Really?
And I was like, really? Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. That, like, if you love, like, you got to get Pet Sounds. So that was one of my shopping trips.
Which friend was this?
This one might have been a dude at school that was one grade higher, drove, Carmen Ghia.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a car?
Carmen those were Ghia. Really popular.
Yeah, yeah. And he had, him and his group of friends, they had a Billionaire's Boys Club, like in the, what's that movie? Is it Pretty in Pink or, one of those 80s movies where they have Andrew McCarthy and David Spader, right? Yeah. And they're like in a club. Anyways, long story short, he would advise me on music. Like the first CD I ever owned, can you guess what the first CD I ever owned was that he convinced me to buy?
What?
Pink Floyd, The Wall, Gold. It was the gold CDs, you know?
Yeah.
So it came, it was awesome. But anyway, so I went and I bought Pet Sounds. In this case, it was a tape. It wasn't a CD. It was a tape, so I could listen to it in the car. I was fairly blown away. Yeah. Because, first of all, I did know who the Beach Boys were, mostly from that Kokomo song. But then I listened to this, and I was like, in that album, it belies the fact that, yeah, they're still trying to do the beach thing and whatnot. But the music was so interesting. Mm. And they were mixing crazy, interesting sounds and the harmonies and the way the chord changes changed. And it was really interesting.
So you were into Pet Sounds before you were into the Beatles?
No, I was already into the Beatles. But but see, the thing with the Beatles was like, I took them for granted. Like, well, that's the Beatles. It's almost like saying, it's almost like discovering that there's a whole other range of colors that you don't know about, no one knows about. For me, it was like discovering that, oh yeah, well, I know that the Beatles are great. Are there other great bands like this? Like,
yeah,
that's
great. Yeah.
So Pet Sounds was a discovery for me.
I remember having similar experiences since I was so into the Beatles so early in my life. And then later on realizing, oh, there were other good bands in the 60s?
Yeah, exactly.
I had no idea. And then I remember hearing God Only Knows, which is just one of the most beautiful songs.
It is.
I heard it, I think, when I was a kid, but I don't think I really understood the song and its beauty until I had sort of graduated to a certain understanding of harmony and structure and melody. And I was obsessed with that song for a while. In fact, to this day, there are times when it just becomes an earworm, a pleasant earworm, if you will. Yeah. And I'll just find myself humming and singing that song.
Ba, 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 yeah. Ba,
but it's ba, also this song, just to talk about that song for a bit, its structure is actually quite complex. It's a simple song in a way, which is always the beauty of the great pop writers like the Beatles and other people, and Nirvana, is they're... It's a very simple song. It sounds simple, but it's actually quite complex, and it's doing a lot of things that you don't expect. Yeah. There's a lot of notes in that song that actually don't make any sense, that if you actually wrote a song, you would be, oh, I made a mistake there. That's not even in the right key, you know?
Yeah.
There are lines even in the melody that I don't know the exact terminology, but it changes keys or modes throughout the song, and you can hear that, right?
Yep. Yeah, well, it's one interesting thing like that is the, you know, a band that I love is The Cure, and take the song Love Song, which was one of their hits.
Can you sing it?
Yeah, you know, whenever I'm in love with you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You make me feel. Okay, so anyways.
Is that on Disintegration?
Yes. So that song, if you just play it on a guitar, just an acoustic guitar, the melody and the chords are really basic. It's really straightforward. It's a pretty melody, but it's really straightforward. But the arrangement that they put in and all the little layers of melodies and counter melodies just is just genius. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So it's deceptive because you're right. It's a simple song, but it's not arranged simple at all, and yet it sounds simple.
And then I heard that Paul McCartney, whom I've always been obsessed with, was influenced by the Beach Boys. And I was like, what? I mean, because to me, it's like the Beatles are the geniuses, the top geniuses of all time.
Right.
And the Beach Boys are like a silly band that had silly songs. I equated the Beach Boys with music like Splish Splash, I Was Taking a Bath. You know, like I just equated them with just silliness, you know?
Surf music.
yeah. And then I heard that Pet Sounds was one of the best albums ever. And I remember thinking that was strange.
And it influenced
Sergeant Pepper.
Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah. Well, today I want to talk about the movie Love and Mercy because it came out last year and some people have asked us, since we always talk about movies, let's talk about the psychology of love and mercy. What do you say?
Absolutely.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I am chair of the Couple and Family Therapy Program at Antioch University, Seattle, and I'm also a licensed therapist.
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I am a Cadillac salesman.
That's interesting. So listener Danielle wrote in and said, I just finished watching Love and Mercy, the bio flick about Brian Wilson, and I absolutely loved it. I think it would be an excellent movie for you and Humberto to discuss since the film goes deep into Brian Wilson's mental illness and his crazy psychologist. Mm. There are so many great elements up for discussion. The Wilson family drama, auditory hallucinations, and of course, the messed up relationship between Brian and Eugene Landy, his psychologist. I always love your movie discussions, and this one would be great too. Well, thanks, listener Danielle. You are super rad. Well, let's get into it. It's a biopic or a biopic, as you and me both thought that word was pronounced. I like biopic.
It's a biopsy.
Yeah. Maybe that's where it comes from, too. It's a 2014 biopic directed by Bill Pohlad, who also he's mainly a producer. He produced Brokeback Mountain, Into the Wild, The Runaways, which is another music movie.
Is that
movie.
The one about the...
Joan Jett.
Patty... Oh, no. Oh, Joan Jett.
Okay. Well, it's about The Runaways.
The Runaways.
With Joan Jett and one of the... I think the bass player from the Bengals was in The Runaways. The Tree of Life, which we've talked about before, which is terrible.
Which I haven't seen, but...
Which is terrible. Oh, by the way, in our Oscars episode, you and I were talking about... I think I said something like Malick's first movie, The Thin Red Line. I always just love this. Someone listened to 2.5 hours of you and me talking.
I caught a mistake.
And I made one... I mean, how many facts did I throw out? And I was just speaking... It was, and what I should have said is the first Malick movie I remember, which is A Thin Red Line. But apparently it was not his first movie. And someone on YouTube was like, you idiot. It wasn't... you know, he had several movies before that. And I'm just thinking, okay, 2.5 hours of listening to... I mean, I don't want people to listen to us if you don't want to. But if you are... Only listen if you like us. And then if you have feedback, feel free to just say, hey, enjoyed the episode, but just to let you know.
Or even say, I didn't like the episode, and to let you know.
Right. But that's the only thing he said was, dude, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, really? You know? Okay. He also produced 12 Years a Slave and Wild.
Well, he was also the director in Apollo 13.
He was?
Yeah, and he also wrote the script for Quentin Tarantino's The Fantastic Four.
Really?
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Oh, I'm just making up shit so that people can complain about
it. Oh, my God. I was like, what the hell are
gonna
you
take
talking
some,
about?
I'm going to take some shrapnel off of you.
Okay.
See, if I give enough misinformation, they can't fault you for shit.
Usually I can detect your BS, but I was looking at you like...
The Fantastic Four?
Quentin Tarantino, what are you talking about? okay, the movie Love and Mercy focuses on Brian Wilson, who is the co-founder of the Beach Boys and the main artistic writer, the main artistic visionary of the five-person Beach Boys. Most of the Beach Boys were all brothers and cousins and whatnot, right?
Right.
And the movie has two chapters, basically, or two two main sections. And the first section takes place in the 60s, and the second section takes place in the 80s.
So they're kind of interleaved a bit. Yeah. They go back and forth a bit.
Right. And so they are... It's a very interesting way to make a movie, and they chose two very different actors to play the young Brian Wilson versus the old Brian Wilson, and they look nothing alike.
Yeah.
So it got 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is very high.
Yeah.
And it stars the following people: Paul Dano, John Cusack, Elizabeth Banks, and Paul Giamatti. And I just want to say, you just watched the movie.
That's right.
Over the past 2 hours, and while you were watching it, you were texting me that you wanted to have sex with Paul Giamatti.
Not quite the wording I used. I said I think I'm falling in love with Paul Giamatti.
It was nominated for a Golden... Paul Dano, or Dano. I think he goes by Dano. He was nominated Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor, which is interesting. It's like... Supporting? Wasn't he the lead actor in that?
It's interesting, because John Cusack was probably the...
But they only chose John Cusack, in my mind, because he's a bigger name.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, if you just asked me lead, I would have said Paul Dano, because doesn't he take up most of the time in the movie?
Perhaps.
Yeah. Anyway, it had no Oscar nominations, the movie, because it's not a big enough movie, apparently. Okay. So let's talk about Paul Dano for a second. Paul Dano. His girlfriend is Zoe Kazan, and apparently she has a very famous Twitter account in which she talks a lot about him, which is very cute. She's an actor and a writer and a director.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The first movie I remember seeing Paul Dano in was Lie, or L-I-E. He's a kid in this. This was a movie from 15 years ago, and he's a kid in it. And I remember really liking that movie, L-I-E.
Wasn't he in Dazed and Confused?
No.
Wasn't he in...
He's in The Girl Next Door. Have you seen that movie?
Yes. The Girl Next Door is what I was thinking of.
He's really funny in that. Really funny in that. And then the big movie, his breakout role was in Little Miss Sunshine. That was his big role. And then right after that, There Will Be Blood, where you're just like, holy crap, this guy can act.
Yep.
Because The Girl Next Door was comedy, you know, whatever. Little Miss Sunshine, you know. But then There Will Be Blood. Holy mackerel. What a great movie. What a great performance.
So was the young guy in Mars Attacks in Dazed and Confused?
I don't know. He was also in Where the Wild Things Are. He was a voice. I think he was one of the guys. And then there's this movie called Meek's Cutoff. Have you seen this movie?
No.
It is bizarre. It's him and his girlfriend, Zoe Kazan, are actually in it. And Meek's Cutoff, it has Michelle Williams in it, and I can't remember who's the lead guy in it, but it's a movie about a group of families that are heading west, I think, during the pioneer days, and it's like a documentary about this, and it's very slow, but I loved it. I just thought it was
weird.
Yeah, and there's no plot. It's almost like a weird recreation of what it would be like to be a family heading out west in one of those stagecoaches with the cloth thing over the top. Anyway, and then he's in Ruby Sparks, in which Zoe Kazan, his girlfriend, actually wrote and directed this and co-starred in this movie with Paul Dano, in which
I heard about that movie.
Paul Dano is a writer, and he writes a girlfriend into existence.
I remember this.
And I loved this movie when I first saw it.
Maybe I heard from you. Maybe that's where I heard it, because I remember someone telling me, hey, Ruby Sparks.
Or yeah, I thought it was the best movie of 2012. I recently rewatched it and significantly brought it down in terms of... I still think it's a great movie, but for some reason when I saw it in the theater, I just thought it was beautiful, it was touching... It was interesting. It was almost realistic in what would happen to you if you wrote someone into existence. Because that always bothers me in movies or TV shows when something really strange happens and everyone's just like, they just have like 5 seconds of shock and then they just move on. Well, in this movie, Paul Dano and the people around him like are freaking out for... for weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
They're just like, this is crazy, you know. Anyway. And then same year, he was in Looper as the friend.
I forgot about that.
And then 12 Years a Slave.
Which I haven't seen. I know, don't hold it against me.
And then he's amazing in Prisoners. You have to see that movie, Prisoners. Yep. He goes through a lot of shit in that movie. It's terrible. Okay. And then he was in Love and Mercy. Okay. John Cusack.
Never heard of him.
Sometimes I get compared to John Cusack. People say I have John Cusack hair. Can you see it?
I can see that.
Like, you kind of have John Cusack hair.
Yeah, I definitely have been told the hair thing.
The first movie I remember him in was 16 Candles, in which he plays one of the nerds. And then The Sheer Thing, which I really remember in 85. I remember that movie. That was like made for the 14-year-old Kirk.
Sure.
The Sheer Thing. And then Better Off Dead, same year.
Yep.
Huge movie of my childhood.
I can imagine.
I'm sure if anyone watches it as an adult, they think this is an idiotic movie. It's stupid. But to me, when I was 14, that movie was, I mean, me and my friends quoted that movie forwards and backwards.
Yeah.
We knew every line.
He just fit that role so well, you know, the kind of bright, snappy, but very like dark teen, you know,
yeah,
who at any minute might kill himself or might have a party or.
Well, that was the thing. You couldn't define him.
He
could be a nerd. He could be cool. Yeah. I kind of see him as like the younger Tom Hanks or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In his older age, he's not so much, but when he was young, he could sort of play anything. I felt like a lot of guys.
You could almost say anything.
That's right. He was in One Crazy Summer, which is just one of those 80s movies. He was in Tapeheads, which was this weird kind of indie movie that he was in. I think with Timothy, what's his face? Then Say Anything. Which takes place in Seattle, by the way.
In Your Eyes.
Yeah, amazing movie. Lloyd Dobler, again, very quotable to our generation. Huge movie. The Grifters, Gross Point Blank. I remember.
Oh, that's a good movie.
Con Air, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which is one of the first books on tape I listened to, which I remember really liking. And then I remember going to Savannah? It takes place in Savannah, Georgia, I think. Midnight Garden of anyway, and I went to the different houses that the movie was or the book and the movie were anyway. Thin Red Line, which we were just talking about, Pushing Tin, which I remember being John Malkovich.
So Pushing Tin,
yeah.
The funny thing with that one, I've never seen it.
Oh,
but when the preview came out, you know, don't let go, you got the music in you, right? And it had the preview with John Cusack and. Billy Bob Thornton. Billy Bob. And all I remember is thinking, I have no idea what this movie is about. I guess they're air traffic controllers. I don't really know.
Yeah, they're aircraft.
But the name is Pushing Tin. And at the time, me and my friends started using the expression. I basically started saying Pushing Tin when we meant that we were either going to be late for something or it was already too late for something or things had gotten way out of control. So we're like, dude, we got to leave now. We're pushing tin here. and from there on, like, we started using that expression. And years went by. To this day, I use that expression like, man, we're pushing tin here. Never having seen the movie, using the expression, I'm sure, completely wrong. Like, it was, and it never dawned on me what pushing tin meant.
Yeah.
Until years and years later.
Do you know what it means?
Well, you're moving the airplanes around. Yeah. But I didn't get it.
That's funny. Then being John Malkovich, huge.
Malkovich.
Huge movie. High Fidelity, which I recently rewatched and actually enjoyed.
I did too, actually.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah.
It's on Netflix, right?
I own it, but.
Oh, you own it?
Yeah. It's one of the ones.
Holy crap.
Well, because it's like when it came out. It's a music movie. I get almost every music movie.
Oh, right.
And it felt like a Cameron Crowe movie almost, you know? Because the soundtrack was good. And
I feel like we should do top five things like that every once in a while.
We should.
And it was one of the first Jack Black movies, I think.
That was a revelation because I knew about Tenacious D, but I didn't know he could act and he could be entertaining. And
then he was in Serendipity and then Identity, which is a weird movie about
I saw that.
Multiple personalities, I think. Hot Tub Time Machine.
I saw that.
Which is good. I liked it.
That first one was funny.
First one was funny. And then Love and Mercy.
Wasn't he in Insomniac?
Was he in Insomnia?
Oh, no. That was Robin Williams, right?
Yeah.
But then what was the horror movie he was in where it's a hotel?
Oh, yeah.
And
I only included the movies that I recognized. Elizabeth Banks is in this movie.
I love her.
The first movie I remember seeing her in was Wet Hot American Summer, which was 15 years ago. Were you a Wet Hot American Summer fan?
I wasn't. I never heard of it.
When it came out, I was a huge fan of that movie. It was like a cult classic. Mm-hmm. It's really great. And it has so many famous people in it.
Turns out, yeah.
Yeah. Apparently, she was in Spider-Man, which I don't really remember. She was in all the Spider-Man movies.
Really? She was a reporter, maybe, or something?
I don't know. She was in Catch Me If You Can, which I don't really remember. She was in The Baxter, which is made by the guys from Wet Hot American Summer, which is pretty good. She was in A 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Yep.
You know that scene?
Yes.
She's really funny in that. She was in Zach and Mary Make a Porno.
Yep.
Which is, you know, a pretty good movie. Role Models, which is also... She's in a lot of bro movies.
You're right.
Role Models, Our Idiot Brother. Then she's in The Hunger Games as the evil...
That's right.
You know, aristocrat woman.
She's in 30 Rock.
She's in a cameo in a lot of TV shows. She's in the Lego Movie. She's the voice. I think she's the voice of the lead girl.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Walk of Shame, recently a movie which I actually recently watched. It's funny. She's at a club. She goes out celebrating or something. She loses her keys and her wallet and her phone. And through LA, she has to get back home because she has an important gig on the TV. Like she's a TV reporter or something. And the whole movie takes place from like midnight till 8 a.m. And she's trying to get home. And there's a police chase and it's comedy. And it's a fun watch. Paul Giamatti, your lover.
My love interest.
Apparently he was in Singles, which I don't remember.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah, I think he was one of the dates.
Was he?
Or some of that, yeah.
That's funny. That's what I thought. I was like, was he one of the video dates? He was in Donnie Brasco. I remember this. He was one of the cops when they're doing The Wire and they're listening.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I love Donnie Brasco. That's another one I own.
The first movie I remember really loving Paul Giamatti is American Splendor, which is a movie about that comic artist, adult alternative comic.
That's right.
But his big breakthrough role was Sideways.
Was that his breakthrough?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, at Sideways, that was a strangely popular movie for 2004.
It was, and I remember that. For some reason, I thought he had something. But you're right. I mean, that's probably...
It's always weird. When I was looking at Paul Giamatti's big movies, he doesn't have a lot of big movies. He's been in a lot of random things, and everyone knows who he is, but he hasn't actually been in a lot of things. Then he was in
Private Parts.
Which I don't remember. I haven't seen
Howard
that.
Stern's
I haven't
movie.
Seen that.
That was good. And he was in it.
He was in the TV miniseries John Adams. He plays John Adams.
Oh, I heard that was good.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
That.
Yeah. 2013 Turbo, the cartoon with the snail. Highly recommend it.
Really?
Really good. Yeah. 12 Years a Slave. He plays one of the slaves.
Still not seen it.
Oh. Then Love, Mercy, and Straight Outta Compton. Okay. I hope people who listen to this podcast appreciate when I just read off every movie that everyone's ever been in, because it's actually kind of fun for you and me to just think about all these different movies. You
Six
know?
Degrees of...
We haven't even talked about Love and Mercy yet, really. Okay, Love and Mercy starts out in the 1960s when the Beach Boys are emerging in their fame, and it starts like early 60s and moves through the mid 60s. Right. And they start to depict Brian Wilson's emerging mental illness.
Right.
And his conflict with his bandmates, particularly the other main Beach Boy.
Is that his brother? The bearded guy with the cap?
It's his cousin.
Okay. He seemed kind of like the leader that wasn't him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perhaps the leader, the logistics.
Or the strongest voice.
The logistics leader, whereas Brian Wilson was more the creative leader.
Yeah.
He was also a songwriter. There were other songwriters in the Beach Boys, but perhaps none as brilliant.
They seemed like they never really, initially it seemed like they didn't have much of a problem because he was outputting exactly the kind of stuff that his dad and everyone else wanted.
Right.
So whatever. But then eventually he starts both exhibiting odd behaviors, but also going in a different direction that people start not understanding. And
right. Because it's not very poppy and people don't really necessarily like it.
Well, and it's like, this is what's so hard to comprehend, because we think about, you know, you and I are musicians, right? If we went into a studio right now and like, we could whip out a song, we could write a song from scratch and record it, right? But I guarantee you, it will be treading on old ground for the most part.
Right.
We would really have to push ourselves. And there's been some stuff we've done that's pretty, but the thing is, this was the 60s.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, after all these bands that we can be influenced by. Right. This was at a time where they were the definition of extreme, and they were doing woo, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this guy's like, okay, I want voices, and I want this thing swooping down,
yeah,
and you play in a different key. It's like mind-blowing.
Right, right. So many things had not been done before. Like, you and I went to that one symposium where that guy broke down the Revolver album, right? It was at a movie theater, and this guy yep. talked about and had this whole presentation.
But you went and told me. I didn't go to that one.
Oh, you didn't go to that one.
It was, I forget, I had a conflict. I think I might have even been in Colombia at a time.
Oh, yeah.
And I was devastated because it sounded so amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. And he was talking about how the Beatles were, or even going back further to Buddy Holly, who were like the first people to use overdubs, mm-hmm. where normally whenever you recorded music, it was live.
Yep.
Like, you know, when Frank Sinatra sang with the orchestra was there and yep. Frank Sinatra was there. And
if you didn't get it, you do another take.
You just do another take. Whereas the idea that you would record the vocals later or have the lead vocalist sing over the lead vocal track yeah. or add a horn in this or have pet sounds
yeah.
intermingling, you know, that was just not done. And so you're completely breaking new ground in all sorts of ways. Whereas now trying to do that is hard. Right. Yeah. It's hard to do.
And it, here's an example. There's a small anecdote that happened to me in 1997 or 98, maybe. A friend of mine who's actually very into music and is now a DJ. At the time, he knew that I liked recording and I was into computer recording and things like this. So he asks me, hey, I have a question. You're into recording. This Radiohead song, and he plays me a bit of the Radiohead song. He says, like, it sounds to me like there's more than one Tom York, the lead singer. But is that an effect? How do they do that?
Yeah.
And I had to explain. But at first, I didn't understand the question because for me, it was so obvious.
Yeah.
So it's another track. It's like as many tracks as you want, man. Right? Yeah. And this was 1990, so it's already multi-track has been around for years at that point. So. Yeah. But I was in that. I did that on my computer. So for me, it was like an obvious answer. So I was sure I didn't understand the question. And we went around in circles a few times until I finally like, oh, okay. Well, it's a track. And then I kind of showed him. But that was in the 90s. Can you imagine when they were like, oh, you mean we could grab the... And it wasn't a computer. It was like tape.
Yeah. Well,
we could like...
when did you have a computer to record?
Late 90s.
Yeah, late 90s. Yeah. I was going to say, because I was recording multi-track tape in the 80s.
Well, I was recording on computer in 93, though.
That's early.
It was very early. I had a card from an Apogee. It wasn't Apogee at the time. It was Apogee. It was a card from Canada. I had to like special order it. It was I'm showing like a foot and a half long card that went into the computer, my 386. Uh-huh. And that was what allowed me to record at 22 megahertz.
Yeah.
And
like 16?
16 bit audio.
Yeah, 16 bit.
Yeah.
Which isn't, that's pretty good.
But it was great at the time.
Yeah.
Because the only other thing you could do was 8 bit audio
right.
and like 11K.
I remember in 97, 98, I got my first computer rig to record, and it revolutionized my creative process. Yeah. I mean, it made it so much easier. Because before that, I had a 4-track. With a cassette tape. Yeah. I would record everything on 4 tracks on a cassette tape.
Did you do the thing? I used to do this and before I had a multi-track solution. Because even when I was recording on my computer, it was only 1 track at a time. And the program couldn't support more than 4 tracks or something like that.
Oh, really?
But
the computer couldn't hold more than 4 tracks?
Well, because it was so much memory. And like, think about how small hard
drives
were.
But what's the point in having a computer if you can't have more than 4 tracks? Well, sure it wasn't 8 tracks?
It might have been 8 tracks, but it was... But it was,
still, 8...
It wasn't that...
Believe me, take it from me. When I had my 4-track like cassette thing, like it was really hard. You had to bounce tracks.
Well, and there's it wasn't so much like the software. It was more of my computer couldn't handle it, you know. But I also would do the bounce tape to tape, which I'm probably sure you did too, which is you play the song on 1 tape player and record and play along with it and record that onto another tape player and then rinse and repeat. And by the 4th generation, it's mostly noise.
Well, Are you talking, well, I don't know if this is what you're talking about, but when I first started writing music when I was 15 or 16, I could not afford a $400 Tascam four track. I couldn't afford anything. I basically just cobbled together like this really crappy acoustic guitar and a Casio keyboard that was probably like 6 inches long or 8 inches. And it just, and that's what I recorded on. That's what I created music with. And I had two boom, everyone yeah, in the '80s, you had a, there was a billion boom boxes right. around the house. And I, we had two boom boxes and they had microphones on it,
right.
on the front. So you, so I would record into one boom box and then play that boom box back and record
and play along with it
and play along with it. And like, if my little brother ran in the room, that would ruin the recording and I'd have to start over. And what would happen was one of the tape players was slower or faster. And and by the fourth or fifth time of doing this, the recording would be really fast.
Oh, it would speed up.
Yeah. And so I would have to record it slow initially and then add the vocals last, because if I added the vocals first, by the time I was done, it sounded like a chipmunk.
And then on top of that, what I was saying is that adds a lot of the tape noise. So right. every generation, you have more and more tape noise.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So, Pet Sounds, recorded in 1996, or 66. It was, surprisingly, the Beach Boys' 11th album. Did you know that?
Yeah, I read it on Wikipedia.
It's That's pretty crazy. 11th album.
It's crazy.
It was a major influence on rock and psychedelic rock. And its two big songs are Wouldn't It Be Nice?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could... Da, da,
da, if we lived da, together, da, yeah. da, da, then we wouldn't have to wait so long. Da, 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 da. And it's all about wanting to have sex, but needing to get married before you can do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And God Only Knows, which we talked about earlier.
By the way, keep 11th album by 1966. So that explains a lot of why the Beach Boys influenced the Beatles, because to the Beatles, they were very into American music. And the Beach Boys to them was like already an established band when they were kind of still coming up.
Right.
And they were, sure, the music to us now sounds very like beach and stuff, but to them it was still new and fresh. And those harmonies.
Right.
And they really learned from those harmonies, you know?
Right. Right. It influenced Revolver, which came out later that year, which is crazy to think. It's like Pet Sounds comes out in, I think, May. Revolver comes out just like a couple months after Pet Sounds. And Revolver was influenced by Pet Sounds.
Are you sure? So I thought it was Revolver, then Pet Sounds, then Sgt. Pepper's.
No, I'll look it up, but okay, I'm pretty sure Revolver was just after. And it's said on the internet anyway that Revolver was
so the story I read.
Yeah, it came out. Revolver came out in August.
Okay. So, oh no, that makes sense, because basically they were already almost done with Revolver, right?
Well, but their album before Revolver, Rubber Soul, was probably
65.
But yeah, it was late 60, because Help was in 65, and then Rubber Soul. So Rubber Soul must have been later.
So the story I read, this was years. This was like in 1992. I remember reading, because I was very into Beatles biographies, so I would read like every book I could find. And the story I remember reading was Brian Wilson listens to a Beatles album. It must have been Rubber Soul.
Rubber Soul.
And is like...
It's December 3rd, the day before my birthday, in 1965.
And then
I was
like,
negative 5 at that point.
Okay. And then he's like, whoa, this is crazy. We got to do something. And then that inspires him to go further with Pet Sounds. Yeah. And then Pet Sounds comes out, and Paul McCartney is like, whoa, okay, we got to go all out. And then they make Sgt. Pepper's a year later or something. Right. And when Sgt. Pepper comes out, Brian Wilson apparently locks himself in a room for like a month. That's the anecdote.
Right.
That's the fable, is that he was so depressed when he heard Sgt. Pepper's.
Right.
Because it was just like, it blew him away.
Yeah. And it also coincided with the onset of his mental illness.
Yeah.
And, right. And so Rubber Soul comes out, then Pet Sounds comes out, then Revolver, then Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah.
And you can really hear the influence. Although I just have to say, I'm not a super big fan of Pet Sounds. I mean, you said you liked it as a kid.
Yeah. What happened was, it was something that was recommended to me. I got it. I didn't know what to expect. And I heard it. I was like, whoa. And some of the songs, like
God Only Knows,
God Only Knows, And it was at a time where I was starting to discover music theory. I didn't have music theory before that. So like you, I was very curious about, like, because, you know, I was learning very basic music theory, but I'm like, what is this magic, right? I got to be honest. I think half the album was really interesting to me, and the other half was a little too spacey for, or not, or yeah. too major seventh-y for me, yeah. if you will. But it still was very intriguing. I was very, yeah. very, you know, yeah. intrigued by it.
I respect it, but I would never just sit down and listen. Yeah. Aside from God Only Knows, which is by far one of the best songs ever written, the rest of the album, even Wouldn't It Be Nice, is because they're like, yeah, okay, it's fine.
So, I have about 4 or 5 songs on that album that I definitely like.
Rolling Stone in 2005 ranked Pet Sounds second on its list of the 500 greatest albums of all time. I don't know what was first. Maybe Sgt. Pepper. I don't know.
Probably
Bob Dylan or something.
No, it was Beatles, but oh. it would have been...
Oh, Abbey Road.
I think so.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. Then it skips ahead in time to the 1980s, in which Brian Wilson is out of the limelight by now, and he is seemingly unable to take care of himself, and he's completely controlled by Dr. Landy.
So, oh, and by the way, in the 90s, what I thought I knew is that sometime, a long, long time ago, Brian Wilson had some sort of stroke, and he had become permanently impaired.
Huh.
And anytime I saw a picture or saw him talk in any sort of TV or anything, which was very rarely, it seemed that way. Oh, yeah, it seems like he had a stroke. Oh, that's so... I always thought it was this tragedy that in the 60s or 70s, sometime way before me, he had a stroke, and that was the end of Brian Wilson. Yeah. He was alive, but he was like almost a vegetable. That's what I thought.
Huh. So let's talk about the movie and its style. I really liked its tone. It's a very subdued tone, the style, the direction, the writing. There's not a lot of... I don't remember any cheesy moments.
Yeah.
And the director and the writers really let the actors act out the scenes. They don't... There's not a lot of restraints on them. You can really see Paul Dano acting kind of like Paul Dano, and Cusack really being himself as an actor, and Paul Giamatti and Elizabeth Banks. They're all... You can all see themselves sort of shining in those roles. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
There is a threat, an ominous threat, you know, in the movie, though.
Yeah.
From the very first scene... Not the first scene. I don't remember what the order is, but when he's at the car dealership, mm-hmm. and you first meet her and stuff, and you see that dude standing there.
Yeah.
What's going on? He's like, oh, he's my bodyguard.
Yeah.
But he's just standing there, and it's weird.
But you can tell that Brian Wilson, played by John Cusack in that scene, is he's almost like a kid trying to run away.
Yeah.
You can sense he's trying to run away.
Right. But then I got that sense of dread when, like, all of a sudden there's three dudes standing there.
Right. So if you haven't seen the movie, and we're not spoiling anything because there's not really a plot to spoil aside from a couple moments, which we'll try not to say. But in the 80s, John Cusack is playing Brian Wilson, and he's being controlled by Dr. Landy, played by Giamatti, and a bunch of bodyguards. And by this point, Brian Wilson is basically being treated like, I don't know, like a child, like a developmentally disabled child, where he is controlled. He doesn't make any decisions for himself. He's always turning to Dr. Landy and saying, is it okay if I do this? And Brian Wilson meets Elizabeth Banks, who plays a Cadillac salesperson at the time, and just trying to ask her out on a date, but he's having a lot of difficulty because Giamatti and the bodyguards are intervening. This is all in the
very intrusive,
yeah,
almost cultish way.
Right. Yeah.
And by the way, I remember seeing Brian Wilson in one or two documentaries about music.
Yeah.
In the early 90s, I think, and he was in the
Return of Bruno. Do you remember him from the Return of Bruno? Do you remember the Return of Bruno?
No.
With Bruce Willis.
No.
Remember that whole thing where Bruce Willis and Bruno?
No.
Oh, Bruce Willis is a frustrated musician, I think.
Yeah.
Do you remember the whole
life he is, right?
Yeah. Do you remember the whole like Bruno thing?
No.
Oh my God. So Bruce Willis was huge. He was perhaps the biggest star of the late 80s, early 90s. The moonlighting. Moonlighting? Yeah. Moonlighting?
Moonlighting?
Moon.
I never saw it.
Moonlight? Moon? Anyway. God, it's like.
Moonlighters?
No, I think it was Moonlighting. Anyway, that show dominated my life in high school and early college. Yeah, I mean, everyone was like, oh, when are they going to fall in love?
So I don't think they showed it in Columbia, actually. That might have been
okay. Well, and so Bruce Willis, at the height of his fame, he was really just sort of losing it, you know, when he made Hudson Hawk, which was, you know, universally panned. He also wanted to create this character where he was this blues singer. And
that was Bruno?
Yeah. And he made a whole movie about, it was a mockumentary about him, like, returning to fame or something. And
that's weird.
Brian Wilson was in it anyway.
Well, what I was thinking is, was he still under control from this guy in the 90s?
I don't think so.
Okay, because I remember him in interviews, and he did seem as someone who had had some sort of a stroke or something. Because he would talk like this. He couldn't talk right.
Yeah.
He was very slow. He seemed like he really wasn't there.
Yeah.
So my assumption was, oh, yeah, poor guy.
You know? Right. And I don't really know much as to why he's like that. And I don't know, he might have always been like that. But yeah, when you see interviews with him from the 80s forward, he sort of talks out of one side of his mouth. But people who are deaf in one ear, which he is, will sometimes talk out of one side of their mouth, and it kind of looks as if they have numbness on their...
I actually didn't know the deafness thing.
Oh, you didn't?
Because what I remember is sometime in the late 90s or something like that, I remember some documentary coming out, like they were talking about like some new revelations that apparently Brian Wilson had been controlled for years and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then I was like, what?
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, he's not actually permanently disabled and he's going to put out a new album. Right. Whenever that was, I was like, my mind was blown. I'm like, what?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's almost like he was in a cult of one.
Yeah.
You know, there was one cult leader and one cult follower.
Yeah.
And he was lost for years in this weird cult of Dr. Landy.
Right.
Well, I really loved the movie because the main thing I loved about the movie was seeing what it was like to sort of be a fly in the wall of the Beach Boys during the 60s. Because the Beach Boys are kind of an enigma to me prior to this movie. Because, you know, I've seen a million depictions of the Stones and the Beatles and the Doors and just all sorts of other bands. Plus, the whole rock and roll persona is kind of locked down. But the Beach Boys always confused me because they're not rock and roll.
Right.
They're not punk. You know, they're not bad boys. They're clean-cut kids from California. And they're into surfing, which has always kind of, you know, 60s surfing is always so quaint, you know. And incidentally, I heard that none of them surf or something.
Probably.
Like they had a million songs about surfing, Surfing USA being the biggest one. And reportedly, like, they don't surf. So it was just a big, you know, marketing thing. Because in the early 60s, surfing movies and beach movies and were all the rage with the kids. But I loved seeing, oh, okay, I get it now. I have a sense of what it was like to be Ground Zero, Beach Boy, California during that time in the 60s. I also loved the scenes of making Pet Sounds. What did you think?
Yeah, that was like, because for anyone who likes music, especially if you've recorded, oh my gosh, it's like, and the work. Oh, the other thing that helped is I had seen that documentary that you had told me to watch.
Yeah, The Wrecking Crew.
So seeing them represented in that movie too, where it's these amazing studio musicians, and just see him work with them and them being impressed by him, and so cool.
Right. And let's see, I loved the scene in which he's playing an early version of God Only Knows to his father.
Right, with just the kind of the chords and the voicing of the chords, and he's singing really softly, and the dad's like, bleh.
I heard that Paul Dano had to take 6 months of voice lessons to be able to sing in those scenes.
Did he sing in that scene?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's playing piano. I'm pretty sure that's that whole thing is live. He's playing that piano. He's singing that song. And it's so great because it's my favorite scene of the movie. Because it starts off with, I think you just see him playing the chords, and then it pulls, it's just one shot. He pulls away. You see, oh, it's, you know, it's Brian Wilson. He's singing God Only Knows. And the camera kind of swings around, and then it comes up to the dad. Yeah. And the dad looks displeased. Yeah. Brian Wilson stops and he's like, what do you think, Dad? What do you think? And his dad's like, oh, I don't know. I don't know about this one.
Yeah. In fact, he goes further eventually to say, if I'm being honest, I really don't like it.
Yeah. And it's perhaps the best song, one of the best songs ever written. And his dad is like, I don't know about this. And I can really relate to this because, and I'm guessing you can too, Berto, because how many songs have you and I written in our lives? Thousands of songs. And every time I write a song, and tell me if this is your experience, I love the recording. I mean, I love the composition. The only reason why I've written it is because I love it.
Right.
Like, it's not like, well, this is one of my mediocre songs. When I'm writing it, I'm like, this is the best song I've ever. Even though it can't possibly be, but it just, the feeling of that being in the zone of creation and that the euphoria of finding the moment and the progression and to have it all kind of like emerging like out of your soul and out of your spirit and you're playing this thing and then you go to someone close to you who has probably been subjected to thousands of other moments like this and to them it's just another one of your stupid songs and
'cause in your head you're hearing this choir of angels and the pipe organ and you're singing lies and it's your song and the heavens are parting. And then you're playing, but if you're seeing it from the other perspective, it's like clink, clink, and I'm a great musician.
And then the other person is like, huh, okay, well, so what do you want to do tonight? And it's just like such a letdown.
Yeah, you're like, Wait. Did you hear the song? Yeah, no, I heard it.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I need to play it again. Maybe you didn't. Maybe I didn't play it right. It's like, no, I heard it.
Yeah. That's happened to me so many times. And at a certain point in my life as a musician, I just realized I'm basically doing this for myself.
Yeah, dude, I had to go through that too because it was like, you know, like you said, you show it to someone who you respect their opinion or someone's close to you, and you're waiting. It's like, oh, that's pretty good. Wait, pretty good?
What are you talking
about?
This
is the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Okay. But again, this movie was a little too long. What do you think?
It was 2 hours long almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like they're getting out of control. At some point, movies were always 90 minutes or less. And the producers and the studios would say, dude, you got to get it down to 90 minutes. Right. And there were some movies where it was a travesty, like Apocalypse Now or The Godfather or something, where it's like you edit it down and you're just like, it's a terrible movie at that point. And so very, very few instances where it's actually justified to go beyond the 90 minute. And then at a certain point, I think it was like about 5 years ago or something, suddenly, if you made any movie that was a non-comedy, it had to be 2 hours or longer.
Two and a half, yeah.
Like A Wolf of Wall Street, The Revenant.
Let's put this out right now. There is no need for a yearly epic. We don't need one every year. And there's more than one every year now that is like 2.5, sometimes 3 hours long. It's like, that should come every 5 years, maybe.
Okay, Hollywood, you're allowed to make one movie a year longer than 90 minutes. You choose which one. The rest have to be 90 minutes or less.
Fine, I'll go with that. And I won't see that one, but fine.
Also, according to many first-hand sources, this movie is very accurate to the true story. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah.
It seemed well researched. It also seemed very respectful. Yeah. Even the Paul Giamatti character, the therapist. I mean, it's a weird thing to say, but I almost felt like it was respectful to him. I'm sure he wouldn't see it that way.
I'm sure most people, when they see this movie, they're like, that Dr. Landy was
wacko
and evil.
Yeah.
Like Darth Vader or something.
But yet, I mean, you know, if I didn't know who Brian Wilson, like if I didn't have any context and I was just hearing him talk about this person, I might actually be like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know. Like when he's like, you don't understand. I found him in a bed, locked in a room, dying from eating too much and suicidal. He could die, right?
Right.
Then some part of you goes like, oh, well, maybe it is that dire.
Right.
I'm not a doctor.
Right.
I don't know.
That's the part you have to see through. Now, let's get into Landy's unethical behavior. But it's not as if he just swooped in and sort of took over Brian Wilson's life for no reason. It started with a good idea, which was Brian Wilson spent, you see him say in the movie, actually it was 3 years. He's, you know, doesn't Elizabeth Banks, were you actually holed up in your room for 2 years?
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, well, actually it was three years.
But I don't say that. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's some debate as to whether or not even that's true, but it sounds like it's possible that, and there are other accounts saying that for 3 years in the 70s, I believe, he stayed in one room, drank alcohol, took drugs, slept, watched TV, gained a ton of weight, became obese, and would occasionally leave the house to go to a bar in LA, and was, you know, not doing well. And somehow someone convinced him to talk to Dr. Landy or whomever, and they made him functional, and they had him lose weight, and he got on medication, and he started managing his finances better, and he started writing music again. Dr. Landy, and you could argue, was pivotal in helping Brian Wilson return to making music. So on one hand, it was a good idea, but let's get into the unethical behavior.
Oh, and sorry, and before you get into the unethical behavior, one more thing is that they did show us, and I'll fault the movie about this in a second, but they did show us in the flashbacks, they showed us that he had problems getting along with, it wasn't just that his dad was abusive, it was getting along with his brothers and cousins. He had problems, and he started having hallucinations.
Right.
And he started doing really, hearing voices and doing very odd things. So there was a real issue. That one was not made up.
Right. And I imagine if the general public watches this, it seems like it's a travesty that this evil person. But when I see this movie, I see, oh, Brian Wilson had a serious mental condition that without a lot of support and perhaps structure, he might have died.
Yeah.
And so I understand at least the impetus to the structure. Okay. So, Dr.
Landy,
what's his first name? Dr. Someone Landy. Okay. So let's talk about the unethical behavior. What do you think was unethical? How would you describe it? You're a lay person.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, the first scene where I thought, because again, pretending I didn't know any context or any background, the first scene where I was like, well, that's out of line is when, he starts, they're at the boat, they're on the boat, I think, and he's like, I'm really hungry.
No, they're on the, I think they're on a deck.
Burger. Okay, maybe it's a deck. It's like, I want a burger, I'm really hungry. It's like, you're not hungry, you're just making it up. I'm like, okay, but I'm really hungry. And then he takes a bite from the burger from her, and then he comes over and just gets in his face like, I told you, you're not hungry, you can't keep doing that. And like, he's yelling and cursing and insulting him right in front of, I was like, whoa, like, dude, that's not, I don't know if it's ethics or something, but that's all sorts of wrong.
Yeah.
That was the first scene where I was like, all right, even if I didn't know the context, like, that doesn't seem right.
Well, if there was an ethical code that this was breaking, what might it be? Can you take a guess?
Okay. So if I was thinking about ethics, I think that part of it is that, things have to be consensual and maybe they have to be, respectful of the wishes of the folks around the person, unless he's he or she is completely well, actually, no, that's true, because you might have a relationship just with the therapist.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess maybe it's just about being respectful to the patient.
Right. It's well, you said it, which was consensual. The client has to consent to treatment. You can't force treatment upon a client unless you're under very special circumstances.
Like court order type.
like court order or you believe that the person is in imminent danger. And even then, you as a therapist can't do something. You actually have to involve mental health professionals that are designated by the government and special inpatient procedures and this sort of thing. And so you as just a regular psychologist or clinician working with someone, you don't have that leeway.
It also seems abusive. So
right.
Maybe it's, I don't know what part of the ethics code would be, but there's some aspect of abuse going on.
Right. That's the other element is consent and client autonomy was mm-hmm. what they'll talk about in ethics. Clients deserve autonomy and a choice in what treatment they get and in how they're treated. And then the other thing is it's just flat out abuse. That's abusive. You can't be, no matter what sort of treatment you think is good, even if you think it's a good idea to abuse your client, it's still unethical because it's harmful. It's, you know, do no harm is, yeah. you know, is one of the, in essence, one of the principles of psychotherapy. Any other unethical behavior that you can see?
Yeah, well, then there was also over-medication, it seemed like. He was, according to the maid, was it? It seemed like he was giving him way too much, like over-prescribing him potentially.
Well, some people take a lot of medication, so how can you differentiate between unethical amounts and ethical amounts?
Only in retrospect, because in the little text at the end, it said that his diagnoses of him had been reversed by a different group or court or something like this. So my feeling is that he was not using proper science to medicate Brian.
Well, yeah, actually, it's funny because the people who made the movie either didn't understand, but obviously the audience doesn't understand, because from a few sources that I read, that whole thing was actually not well described. So the literature I saw, Landy and people had diagnosed him in the 70s with manic depression and paranoid schizophrenia.
Uh-huh.
And gave him medication according to those diagnoses. Then in the movie and in other literature, they say, and it was overturned later. His wife said that they went to a different clinician and they diagnosed him with schizoaffective disorder. But the thing is they're very similar presentations. I'll just say that paranoid schizophrenia and manic depression, the presentation of that is very similar to schizoaffective disorder. And then some people actually believe all three of those disorders are actually one disorder, just manifesting in different ways, if that makes any sense. And so to say that it was overturned and then he had a different diagnosis is a bit of a trick, I think, that they're either playing on purpose or they don't realize they're playing. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes sense. I guess the other part that seemed unethical to me is that he was going out of his way to break relationships beyond, outside of Brian Wilson's desires.
Yeah. Why is that unethical?
These other people haven't made an agreement with the doctor, the therapist, and the person who's getting the therapy is certainly not agreeing to it, right? So for the therapist to go even talk to the other person already seems like a breach.
Right.
And then for them to tell him, don't see this person, seems like a double breach.
Right. Exactly. So you are obligated to confidentiality.
Right.
So...
Oh, that's right. He told her, like, oh, he's crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
So if it was me and I just happened to be at a Cadillac dealership with my client, for some reason, I'm just following my client around, I couldn't indicate to anyone my relationship with my client. I could not say I was his therapist. In fact, I couldn't even say that I knew who he was. In fact, I should leave as soon as I see him in the Cadillac dealership.
Right. And okay, so... I suppose that there could be situations. Well, actually, let me ask you this. What if you do have a practice that is meant to be more hands-on by choice?
Yeah.
But, you know, because when they were first at the dealership, the guy says, oh, I'm like a brother from another mother. He didn't say I'm his therapist and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, at first. But so let's say for a second that could fly. But later in the movie, he's actually saying, what you need to understand is he's crazy or he's severely this and that, which seems like that's a complete violation.
Well, the whole all the rest of the unethical behavior can be summed up in what's actually not really understood mm-hmm. outside of my profession, which is what they call dual or multiple relationships. When you have a client, you're supposed to have one relationship with that client. Now, you can have dual or other multiple relationships with clients, but every time you add a relationship, you need to consult and really think about it, and the client needs to consent to it. Everything just has to be very careful. Mm-hmm. The classic example is you are seeing your client, and your client is also a babysitter, and you hire your client to babysit your children. Okay, so now you're in a dual relationship. Yeah. Not only is the client your client, but now they're also your babysitter. You've hired them to do something.
And then you start a sexual relationship with them, which adds slight complications.
That's another classic dual relationship, is a romantic sexual relationship, or even a friendship is considered a dual relationship. So there are so many multiple relationships that he has with his client.
That's right.
Now, if he just was in his office and Brian Wilson came to his office and he treated him and he gave him advice and helped him with his medication, which actually I read that he wasn't even authorized to give him medication. Like he wasn't, I don't even think he was a medical.
Is he not a psychiatrist?
I don't think he was a medical doctor.
No.
So I think like he was prescribing medication that he didn't even legally have authorization to do. But anyway.
You're right. Cause he had a relationship with the maid.
Yeah.
And he would threaten her apparently.
Right.
Right. He had relationships, I'm sure, with, I'm not sure, but it seemed like he had a relationship with the father.
Yeah.
Definitely with this woman.
Right.
I don't know who else, but.
But he was the manager of Brian Wilson's money.
Oh, right.
So he's the official estate manager.
And trying to get him to do music. So it was almost like his producer.
Well, he is listed as a co-writer of songs.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Because Landy fashioned himself a songwriter.
Oh my God.
And so there are some songs still, to this day, that are listed as Wilson Landy compositions.
I got to be honest. Like, the movie did not do a good enough job of making all these things clear.
Right.
That's just.
Right. He becomes basically a social worker. And he becomes basically like his father or his controller. He controls who the client dates and who he sees. He controls where the client lives. He's the manager of the client's diet.
Right.
I mean, imagine me as a therapist physically controlling what my client eats.
Ripping food out of their hands.
Right. And he becomes a business partner and they profit from music sales of their compositions.
That's so messed up.
Totally.
I did not quite get the extent of of the mess.
So all of that is patently unethical. And is that the right word of patently? Patently?
Patent leather.
It's patent leather.
Yeah.
That I patted with my hand.
And that you patented.
my friend Pat patted my
patently leg.
So therapists out there, avoid this sort of behavior. If you want to see what not to do as a therapist, watch this movie.
You know one thing that I fault the movie on? I wished they would have done it, and I think they could have shortened the movie a bit, like you said, but actually I wish they would have connected the dots. I wanted to see when Jamadi first came into his life. Did they show that? Did I miss that?
No.
I wanted to see that. Like, just connect me that, because since they were showing me the past and the present, or, you know, I guess both are the past now, but I would have really liked to see, because the one thing that they left dangling, that they added, whenever you have to add text at the end, it's always a little iffy, but especially if the text you're adding is to fill a hole that you could have showed me.
Yeah.
And so the hole that I didn't see is, how did it get so bad that this guy came into the life?
Right. Well, I listened to maybe it was the DVD commentary, I can't remember, but the writer, director people were talking and saying that the first draft of the script was actually what didn't have a break. It was his entire life. It was Brian Wilson from beginning to end, and it didn't have a jump in time.
I see.
And if I remember right, they were saying they were having a really hard time figuring out how to make it work. How to really, yeah. It's you know, because when you do movies like that, you basically just zoom through someone's life, and it's hard to go deep into anything. And so at some point, somehow they got inspired to do what they did by just depicting two times in his life.
And in general, I feel like that approach wasn't a bad idea. I felt they left the past the 60s dangling, and the only resolution came in the form of the text at the end, where it says Pet Sounds ended up selling a lot of records.
And maybe it's because I understand to some extent how mental illness progresses and works, and I could sort of fill in the blanks of what would typically happen to someone, and honestly wouldn't want to see that in a movie because it's quite difficult to watch that kind of thing. That didn't bother me. But when they made the jump, I remember pretty quickly saying, oh, okay, I can fill in the blanks myself. That was what I did.
I mean, I guess one of the things is this. They made it seem as if the Pet Sounds effort was all for naught.
Yeah.
And if anyone didn't know, right, it would have been like, it all fucked up or whatever.
Oh, really? So in the movie, they don't really...
The only time you know, like, oh, no, it all worked. It's just then he finally declined and then that was it. Is when at the end they say Pet Sounds went on to sell, blah, 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 you know.
Well, maybe you sort of knew because you recognize the songs.
Yeah, I mean, I know. And in fact, I've read enough, so I knew the other.
But I could see how a non-fan would be like, he was recording this meaningless album.
That's right. Yeah. But even as a, and then even as someone that does know, it was still a bit of a mystery why he ended up becoming controlled by Giamatti. So forget the descent into madness. Fine. Skip that. Don't show me that. But it was a bit unclear why he got control. Like, what happened? How did this come about?
Yeah. And what I'll say is this movie depicts well what happens sometimes when a clinician, a greedy clinician, is given too much power over a rich person's life. This happens from time to time. Did it happen to Michael Jackson?
He all but got killed by his physician.
Yeah. Well, I don't know the story behind that so much, but I do know the story behind, I think it was the wife of famous airplane pilot who flew across the Atlantic.
Okay.
His wife was also late in life, very similar situation, controlled by a therapist, drained of lots of funds, and the family was trying to get at them.
So the thing with Michael Jackson is probably not quite as the same scenario, but the rumor is that he wasn't like trying to kill himself or something. Like his live-in doctor gave him a combination that any doctor would have known was lethal. And so it's either was purposeful murder or a complete like dereliction of duty, basically.
Right. I don't know if we know whether or not the doctor was either was controlling Michael Jackson.
That we don't know. Yeah.
Or Michael Jackson was actually... my impression, and I could be wrong, the little I knew, was Michael Jackson was actually asking the doctor for this sort of thing. Charles Lindbergh was his name, by the way.
Ah, Lindbergh.
And his wife, Anne Morrow Lindbergh.
Okay.
She was controlled, I think, by a... Or maybe it was his daughter, but anyway... So I thought that it depicted mental illness fairly well. Mental illness is typically depicted very badly in the movies, and I thought that it portrayed it pretty well. What do you think?
Yeah, it made it seem human. And also did a good job of mixing like the genius part of him in with the difficulties.
Yeah, right. So we see that he starts having hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, and he starts having paranoia. I thought that they depicted the onset of hallucinations fairly accurately. How'd you feel about it?
Well, the one thing that I don't know, maybe you read about it, is how much drugs was he on?
So given our science, we have no way of knowing, but I took notes. Apparently they found that his brain has an actual injury. 1984, Wilson was diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic, with doctors finding evidence of brain damage caused by excessive and sustained drug abuse. But the thing is I question that statement because we don't, particularly in the 80s, don't have the ability to know that for sure. Mm. And there are a lot of things that there's good evidence for, but there's some evidence that it was either drug-induced or drug-exacerbated. Like, he might have been developing a psychotic disorder, and the drug use of which he was taking a lot of all the drugs in the 60s, LSD, pot, alcohol, uppers, downers, he was taking all of it.
Right.
And there's evidence that when you take a lot of different substances, you can speed the onset of your schizophrenia or other issue like that. There's also the possibility that if he never took the drugs, he never would have developed the mental illness at all. There's also evidence with other people that when you are developing a mental illness and panic, he was experiencing a lot of anxiety, that you're more likely to turn to drugs to soothe yourself in the beginning stages as your mental illness is developing. And so sometimes it'll look as though, oh, the drugs caused it. But actually, the only reason why they were using all those drugs is because they were struggling mentally to begin with.
Right. So it's really hard to know.
It's hard to know. Also, you could say trauma played a role. He was severely physically abused by his father as a child, including being hit across the head, which he claims, and there's some evidence for his deafness in his ear, was due to being struck by his father.
Oh my God, dude.
But there's other suggestions that maybe it had nothing to do with that. But at the very least, he was traumatized.
Yeah.
So not only the possibility of a brain injury from his father, but even the psychological impact of being traumatized. So,
oh, so horrible.
Yeah. So according to him, he started having hallucinations in 65, shortly after experimenting with psychedelic drugs. I find this to be the most fascinating part of this that I don't think they emphasized enough in the movie. Because again, the movie is almost like a recreation. Mm-hmm. They don't sprinkle in a lot of commentary. That's why it's a good movie. There's no cheesiness to it. But after researching for this podcast episode, I realized that one could say, and I'm sure people have said it, is that Brian Wilson's use of psychedelic drugs led to him having a condition, the beginnings of a condition that would eventually mean he would be in bed for 3 years. But in the beginning phase, while he still had most of his faculties and he was mostly sane, he was beginning to go insane, we could say, and that he was the perfect person to introduce psychedelic rock and experimentation into our culture, into the world.
Yeah.
Because the Beatles at this point in 65 were writing songs like Help.
Yeah.
And although one could say they would have had a very similar path regardless of the Beach Boys. I mean, who knows? You know, the culture zeitgeist and da-da-da. But you could make an argument that psychedelic rock in the 60s as we know it, and the 70s as we know it, and Pink Floyd, The Wall, and all that stuff was because Brian Wilson, who was a musical genius and was very popular and could get a ton of money with Pet Sounds, like was, I think, the most expensive pop album ever made up until that point. It cost, you know, tons and tons of money for the time. So, and he never would have been able to record that album as depicted in the movie without being a massive star with a ton of dough, right?
That's true.
And he's starting to go insane because of drugs.
Yeah.
And he records this weird album with these weird layers and all these weird sounds. And because he's starting to hear voices in his head, and he kind of says this, I think, in the movie, where it's just like, well, I just hear it in my head. These things are happening in my head.
Yeah.
And so he's going insane, and he starts to essentially paint a picture of his insanity through his music.
Right.
And that completely changes the world music culture for the rest of time. What do you think about that?
It's a valid point to make, I think, that it was at the perfect point to influence a whole bunch of stuff. At the same time, I do think that there were parallel happening, you know. What year was the trip, the Beatles trip? Because that guy was already preaching, Ravi Shankar.
Well, that was 68.
Not Ravi Shankar, sorry. The Yogi.
Yeah.
Yogi.
That was 68.
Oh, okay.
Or late 67, 68.
But he was already like doing his thing. Like, what's the other guy? Donovan, wasn't he already kind of traveling to the East? So, but to your point though, it is in fact Pet Sounds that then these guys go like, whoa, we got to go wackier.
But the thing is, when you think about Pet Sounds as influencing Sgt. Pepper's, which was the biggest album of its time. Yeah. It was massively changing to our culture. Yeah. You can hear direct influences from Pet Sounds.
That's right.
This in Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, dung dung. You know that that harpsichord sound is straight out of Pet Sounds, right?
Yeah, I mean it is, and it's and even the swooping sounds and the and the collages of sounds,
right?
Definitely,
right.
Basically, the psychedelic nature of it.
Right.
That said, though, Revolver did show early indications, but Tomorrow Never Knows, right?
Which was after Pet Sounds.
Which was after, but not significantly after Pet Sounds.
No, but even Help and Rubber Soul, you can see the early...
It was heading there. It was heading there.
So like, I'm only sleeping.
I think it was a cultural movement, but no question, this guy was right there at the front.
Right.
No question.
Yeah.
It does lend some credence to the idea that, wait a minute, was it really just the drugs? Because what about all these other musicians...
That took drugs.
That took drugs as many or more.
Well, everyone's different.
Yeah.
And he might have taken more, you know?
Yeah.
There are certainly anecdotal accounts of people taking too much acid or too much of this and that.
And I guess, to be fair, some of them killed themselves by 27.
Yeah. And actually, you definitely can drive yourself to psychosis, at least temporarily. But... He's still suffering from mental illness now, even though he's not presumably taking drugs anymore. But he is relatively symptom manageable at this point, and he's, you know, getting psychiatric care, and his wife helps him a lot, and so he was able to resume his career as a musician, in the 90s and until today.
Finally released Smile.
Well, right. So getting back to Smile. So Smile was his follow-up album to Pet Sounds.
It took him, what, 30 years?
30 years to complete. So what's the final word? I have a final word. Jamaica, Bahama. Key Largo. I remember driving through Key Largo in Florida and just going, God damn it, that fucking song.
I liked it. But anyways, my final thought on the movie. First of all, I did like the movie. I would have done a couple things differently. One is the length. The other one is connecting the dots a little better. It also really, like, I agree with you. The scenes where they show us them recording Pet Sounds, and that was awesome. I wanted more. I could do a whole 3 hours of just that.
Yeah.
Just show me, like, in fact, forget 3 hours. Real time, the full year, 2 years, however long it took him to record, just show me real time.
Can you imagine a movie, well-made recreation of Sgt. Pepper?
Oh my God. Can you imagine if they had filmed that in IMAX?
I know.
Oh, that would be mindful.
Or just a really great current director who manages to... Someone's got to make a...
This is what's so sad these days, though. There's no... Since the album is kind of dead... You can't actually do this now.
What do you mean?
You can't do a glorious 70mm, let's go film the Beatles' latest album, or the equivalent of the Beatles' latest album.
Like current musicians.
The closest might be like, well, let's go see what Jay-Z's up to or whatever. And I guess that's cool, but can you imagine those masterpieces? Led Zeppelin 4, go in there. The closest is that Yellow Brick Road documentary, the Elton John.
Yeah.
That's really awesome.
I think actually people are making movies like this, but we're just not interested in them.
But it's not the Beatles.
Yeah.
It's not Led Zeppelin.
But I'm guessing there are movies made about like John Mayer making a movie, and we just don't care, you know?
Yeah. Well, and to be fair, there were a few. But anyways, point is, I did like those aspects. I feel really bad that he was abused basically both by his father and the therapist. I was very impressed with the acting. I'm glad that he came out of the dark tunnel and that he's now like living the rest of his life in a healthy way, hopefully.
Well, that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us out there. Please take care of yourself and please become a patron of the podcast.
That's right.
Because we love you and you deserve our love, right?
That's absolutely right.